Greetings, geeks, and welcome to our Summer Blockbuster podcast series. I'm Regina McMenemy, the lead ambassador for the Geek Embassy.
I'm Rhonda Oglesby, the wild card ambassador.
And this is episode 157, recorded on April 26, 2016. We're launching a new summer series of podcast episodes where we're going to focus on blockbuster summer movies. Each month, now through August, we will select a new movie to see and then analyze, celebrate, and critique. We're glad to take your recommendations and suggestions for movies throughout the summer, but we might just have to see the movies we are most interested in, since summer does tend to have a lot of big movies to see. For this month's podcast episode, Rhonda and I both saw The Huntsman: Winter's War.
And to close out, we'll have a couple of streaming recommendations as an alternative to going to the theater for those summer downtimes on your mobile devices. So why don't we get started? The Huntsman: Winter's War opened April 22nd. It is the prequel sequel.
I guess.
To Snow White and the Huntsman that came out back in 2012. And that one starred Kristen Stewart as Snow White. Charlize Theron returns as Ravina in this one, and Chris Hemsworth as the Huntsman. And lucky him, Huntsman now has a name. He is Eric. And added to the cast is Jessica Chastain as Sarah and Emily Blunt as the sister to Ravina, Queen Freya. And actually, I mean, I don't think that the original got very was very popular. I don't think the reviewers cared for it that much, but I kind of liked
it. I did, too. I enjoyed it sort of as a retelling or reworking of Snow White. I think that it kept to some of the spirit of the original fairy tale that is often lost, I think, in translations.
They hinted at sort of a romance between the Huntsman and Snow White, but they let that go.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I appreciated that for one aspect because it was fairly accurate. I mean, you go through a battle or a traumatic experience with someone, you feel close to them, and I think it just showed how much they respected each other.
Mm-hmm.
And admired each other for what they were going to do. But I also thought that the last half of the movie, I don't know, I felt a little female empowerment there. The women were taking care of themselves. They had come up with solutions to their problems, and they were kind of dealing with things. And I kind of enjoyed it for that aspect.
Yeah, I agree. I felt the same way about it. And I am not a big fan of bland face actress. I can't think of her name. The one from the Twilight movies that was Snow White.
Kristen Stewart?
Yes, her. I usually don't like what she does, but I think the story and the caricatures, or the characterization, not caricatures, characterization of in that movie carried her.
Yeah. She's kind of got the same look. It's sort of the female angel. She's always kind of disgruntled or
right,
brooding.
That brooding. Yeah, and everybody jokes it's, you know, resting bitch face, so.
They never called Angel that.
No, they never called Angel that. Of course they didn't call Angel that.
Well, but we liked the first one, and if you think back of the good things that were in the first one, I think we can definitely say that Charlize Theron, first of all, got a lot of notice for that.
Right, yes,
she's
absolutely.
Very, very, very good at being a bad girl.
Right. Well, she was the reason why I wanted to see this movie.
Yeah. She's also gorgeous. And for an actress at her age, which is not old people, she's stunning and she's incredibly talented. The second thing I think would be the special effects.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite things, I think one of my favorite characters is the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime that mirror melts onto the wall, the floor, I love it. I just want to rewind and watch it again.
Yeah.
And then I think just for titillation, I think that people wanted, I'll take that back. That's not fair. I think people wanted more Hemsworth.
I agree.
But I think that's because it was a very provocative character.
Right.
Is a very desirable character. Kristen Stewart was okay, I guess.
Right.
For whatever reason, she didn't come back for the second one. So they wrapped a story around that. And they're like, well, everybody liked The Huntsman. Let's make the story about The Huntsman.
Right.
You saw the first one, you know, Queen Ravenna actually dies, well, you know, she's a witch, we'll bring her back.
Right, exactly. We have resurrection, and her sister can bring her back. And
yeah.
And there's also, because I think the Thor movies were after Snow White and the Huntsman, right? Or around the same time.
I don't know.
Think Chris Hemsworth had as much purchase in when the first one came out in 2012. I might be mistaken about that, but I think he's more popular. So I think making the choice to kind of pull his character out for this one, I think, might have something to do with.
I don't know. Thor came out before.
Did it? Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was after. Okay. Well, then maybe not.
No, I think that Snow White and the Huntsman just got lucky getting him.
Hmm. That could be.
They were. I don't know when the filming was or when the casting was, but I think that was a very happy happenstance for the filmmakers.
Yeah, for the franchise. Yeah, yeah. So what did you think about Winter's War then?
Oh, that was dreadful.
So bad.
It was just, this is what they did good. I mean, Charlize Theron was great. The special effects were great.
Yep. The costumes. I'm in love with the costumes.
The art direction was just, I just don't think I can see so much cosplay.
I can see so much cosplay coming from it. And actually being better than the movie.
Yes. Oh gosh, yes.
Watching people recreate it.
There was, wonderful detail, you know, just in the costuming, but I think in all other aspects, I think the writing was horrible. The direction, mm-hmm. the directing was dreadful. And they didn't have a story, and they completely destroyed the Huntsman character.
Yeah.
I just don't know whether or not that you could have mishmashed. I mean, they ran him through a grinder, spit him out, and ran him through again. And I don't know what they came up with. Sometimes I thought he was like Star-Lord, you know, roguishly.
Right. Well, he always had this, like, this inappropriate smile.
Yes, it was so creepy.
Like, you'd be watching, and it would be all of a sudden he would, like, break into, like, a bro smile, you know, and be like, and I'm like, this is a serious, it's a reasonably serious role. It was a reasonably serious, you know, story for what story was there. I don't understand why all of a sudden you're smiling.
Yeah, it was, they were totally confused, I think. When they went in directing this, and I've seen this happen some before, whenever they come out with a script, they have a very specific idea, they shoot it one way, and then something happens, and they're like, okay, edit it for a comedy.
Right.
And there's no telling partway through this whether they were trying to make it more of a humorous movie maybe in the beginning.
Like, or maybe they realized at some point how this whole prequel sequel thing was, you know, gonna bomb. So they're like, well, let's at least give people a few laughs.
I didn't laugh a single time.
I didn't think it was gonna work.
I think I might have laughed, but oh, and you mentioned the special effects. The best part of the film, to me, besides just the costumes and stuff, the closing credits.
Mm-hmm.
They were gorgeous.
They were gorgeous.
That art direction, you can tell, was completely separated from that movie.
Art direction for this movie was outstanding. The sets, the costumes, the lighting. I mean, everything was gorgeous.
The editing sucked.
The editing was bad.
There was this one scene. It was so bizarre where they cut in and out. They cut back and forth between the back of Chris Hemsworth and then to the face of somebody talking to him and then back to his back. He's not saying or doing anything. And I'm like, this is the most bizarre clip I've ever seen in a film. Why are you cutting to this? It's so weird.
I think I stopped paying attention.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't think about this part of this.
There was nothing to hang your hat on.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, I enjoyed the fight at the end between the sisters. I think the movie should have been more about them because they were the only interesting characters in it. But that wouldn't have been the Huntsman, right?
Exactly. Which I think is just kind of really weird because, all right, besides the fact, like, can we just say as a blanket statement that the whole story from front to back was nothing but a great cliche?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Like, it was every trope. And that was part of why I wanted to see this movie, too, because we have that proposal out for Geek Girl Con to talk about fairy tales.
Yeah.
And superheroes. And so I'm like, well, I should keep up to date on current fairy tales.
Oh.
And so I was like, well, let's see what they're continuing to do with Snow White and this, you know, let's see how they spin this off. And it just... I mean, I'm not going to talk about this. It's a train wreck, but it was good to know.
Yeah. Well, they've got the female cast.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really weird. So you've got two queens, Ravina and Freya, and then you've got Sarah, the female huntsman.
Right.
And so there's three female.
So much potential.
Yeah. And it's so confusing when you then have a movie called The Huntsman, and
right.
I guess just because of that, you've got to have him in every scene, and
I think they just had to milk him for whatever contractual obligation he had to make this movie, so they're like, we're going to get our money for you.
And then, I mean, the ending,
mm-hmm.
Oh my God, it's like, okay, you either get paired off, which is the happy ending, apparently.
Right, that's what all the fairy tales are.
Or you die.
Right.
It's like, you hit me and then you just kept punching me in the face. It's like,
yeah, it was bad.
And it was shallow, and it was thin, mm-hmm. and it's like, I have no concept of what it is to lose a child. But that is so old. That you become a raging maniac bitch and torture people and steal children because you lost a child. I mean, that's kind of a trope.
Right. Well,
and they've given her more. I mean, they almost did at the end.
Right.
And she's having her confrontation with her sister, and more layers are coming out about what happened.
That's what I was looking forward to.
Yeah.
Like, I thought the movie was going to be about the confrontation between the two of them. Like, the younger sister brings the older sister back, and, you know, the older sister thinks she's going to control the younger sister. That's what I thought
the movie
was. That's the story. That's the story right there. Like you could have had a whole movie that was just them, and it would have been amazing, and they would have done great because you had, you know, good acting power there. You could have even had the huntsman and
Sarah.
What's her? Sarah. You could have even had them as an underplot, like a subplot to it, but it was backwards. That's exactly what it was. It was backwards. The story that should have been it should have been about the two sisters and about their war, because that's what's important in it. And then, you know, that could have been a subplot kind of supporting it, or, you know, and had those characters come in and whatever else you want.
But isn't it a plot of Frozen?
No, because Anna doesn't have any special powers.
Oh, tomato, tomato.
Well, but yeah. But I mean, it is Frozen anyway, because,
right.
I mean, she's still Elsa. It doesn't matter. Which is the reason why I stopped watching Once Upon a Time, it's based, the Ice Queen, Hans Christian Andersen. It is, you know, one of the traditional fairy tales. But everybody that's done it since Frozen came out hasn't done Hans Christian Andersen.
No.
They've done Frozen. It's like, hello. I understand we're all, like, you know, worshiping at Disney, but come on.
Well, and that's where you make a movie by focus group.
Right.
Instead of with storytelling. I mean, there was just nothing imaginative.
Mm-mm.
About this at all.
Nothing new. There was nothing innovative. We're going to forget that we've seen it. It's just going to, you know, fade into the background, and that's going to be the end of it.
So did the goblins creep you out?
A little bit, yeah.
I mean, the goblins were apes.
Right.
But you've got to be kidding me. Is there anything more uncreative?
Yeah.
There were just, to me, a lot of things wrong with the goblins.
Yeah.
There just was. There was a lot.
Yeah.
And the fact that they all paired off at the end. And
well, again, you know, the goblins just go back to that, you know, like you said, the tired storytelling tropes, you know, it just kind of feeds back into that.
Yeah. Well, I had a feeling we would have a hard time talking for 20 minutes about this, but I guess since that there's just no end to the number of things we can say bad about it.
with the only nods in the direction being the costuming and the special effects.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness, when that mirror melted into the floor.
Yep.
I loved it. Just loved it.
It was beautiful, but...
We've got sort of a not necessarily totally unique movie rating system, but it goes from 5, which is you must see it in the theater, go, you know, as soon as you can after it opens, this is a must-see, pay your $10 to see it, theater, or a 1, which is don't watch it until it's free on streaming.
Well, I'm going to go somewhere in the middle of that. I think in terms of, if you're like me, and you like sometimes to go to the movies and yell at the screen, go see it in the cheap theater and throw popcorn at it. But don't go it thinking that you're going to have a satisfactory storytelling experience.
Okay. I didn't even give it that much. I would go 1 or 2 on this one. Simply because I really just wouldn't want to pay any money for it. And since I have HD and a big screen TV, then I can rewind it and watch that mirror melt every penny time I want. I want to have a talk with that mirror. Hey, mirror.
Oh, that's funny.
Come on over. Let's have some sushi.
Let's have a glass of wine.
Love the mirror. Well, let's talk about something we like.
Yes. Let's give a positive recommendation.
Yeah. There's so many different ways to watch shows now. And that's the thing about the theater. You hope that you get a chance to go see one of these big blockbusters. And I think we're going to have something to really talk about later on through the summer.
Yeah.
But also,
this is a very lukewarm beginning to this
discussion. It is. We're just wet in the...
You had to start somewhere.
But you're also going to be traveling. You're going to be carrying your iPods and iPods. Whew.
Rhonda.
I hate to say iPod and feel dated.
I know, right? But yeah.
Your iPhone, your iPads, and streaming what you can in the back seat
tablet,
or whatever.
Your Fire, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Weapon of choice.
Yes.
So we just were going to do a couple of recommendations as far as streaming goes. So what did you come up with, Regina?
I'm giving a Netflix recommendation for the French film Amelie.
Oh, good choice. Oh, my God.
Thank you. I thought that was an inspired choice. It's a whimsical, fun, absolutely beautiful, totally unrealistic romantic movie with subtitles.
Oh, it's pretty and colorful and quirky.
And quirky and crazy, and there's garden gnomes. I mean, it's just, there's Renoir. I mean, you really can't go wrong with it. I absolutely love it. It's one of my favorite movies to use in my film as art class. To show sort of a French style of filmmaking, and that sort of, and her character. I just love her character and the story.
And it's got the Audrey Tautou.
Yes.
She's just a wonderful actress. She's done a lot of
stuff. She's done a lot since then. This was one of her first sort of big things, I think.
Yeah, because she was... she was in The Da Vinci Code.
Oh, that's right. That's exactly it, yes.
Yes, and Dirty Pretty Things.
Yes.
Which was a really great movie. I mean, it was hard to watch, but it was definitely a really great movie. I'm trying to think of one of the other first ones that I saw, but I'm not seeing it here on the list immediately, but she's just wonderful. She's
wonderful, yeah. She's got a great face. I love her expressions in this movie, and... There's a lot of stillness in this movie, I think, which is something that sets it apart just in general. And there's a lot of color composition, which is one of the things I talk about when I teach it, that a whole scene will be red, but one lampshade will be blue or something like that, where, you know, it calls attention to color in a way that you don't often see. So,
nice.
Yeah. definitely try. And it'd be fun to watch. I haven't ever watched it on a tablet. I owned, you know, to date myself, too. I have the DVD.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right. You remember those things?
Okay.
But I imagine being able to, like, you could pause it really easily and just sort of kind of take in the grandeur of the images on a tablet.
Yeah.
So what about you? What do you have for to start off summer viewing?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that they had a lot of scenes where there was stillness, because that's one of the aspects that is very prominent in the film I was going to recommend, which is the original, not the original, but the Magnificent mm-hmm. Seven made in the 1960s. They had all-star cast, Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, James Colburn, Charles Bronson, Robert Vaughn, all these guys. And the only reason I thought of it is because they're remaking it. And I just found that out this week, of course, starring one of my favorite actors, Denzel Washington. So I was like, okay, I have to have context. That's my big thing. And so I went back and rented The Magnificent Seven. And what you have to understand is I don't like Westerns. It's my least favorite film genre. Huh. So you know it must be a good film if I like it.
Right.
Just like Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven. I have a hard time finding anything wrong with that movie, Unforgiven. It's just a beautifully written story. And The Magnificent Seven's the same way. The dialogue and almost all the scenes, you look at it and people are all standing still. And you think, okay, is this the 1960s where they just didn't move around a lot?
Right.
But I think that the filmmakers knew exactly what they were doing, because what they were dealing with in some aspects are seven men who are very, very fast gun shooters.
Mm-hmm.
They are quick draws. And I think that it was done in contrast to show it raised a lot of tension in the film. It raised a lot of awareness, and it sort of gave you a tingly feeling whenever action did happen.
Right.
Because it was so...
Because it built up to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The dialogue is unforgettable, and it's completely fitting for the characters. They're almost all men. I think there's one woman in the film who actually has a name. But it's about men in this particular situation. So I really don't have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but it's beautiful. It's got a dull, yeah, dirty palette, which it definitely needs. That's the only real difference between Amelie. Amelie, the way you described it, reminds me of that Adam Sandler movie. Happy Gilmore. Punch-Drunk Love.
Oh,
I
don't think I've seen Punch-Drunk Love.
They use a lot of color in it as well,
huh.
And it's.
Okay.
It's a very strong character in that film, and I remember Amelie the same way. And it's,
yeah.
I tell you what, if you find a director who can do that, boy, that's a powerful film.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, and that's one thing that's interesting about sort of Westerns is they need, like, as you said, to have that sort of dirty, you know, washed out
mm-hmm.
palette.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of what gives it its ambiance. And The Magnificent Seven really stands out. I think The Magnificent Seven's actually a remake.
Yes.
The original, right? It was the Samurai.
Seven Samurai.
The Seven Samurai, right, was the original. I'm trying to remember. This is pulling on lots of my my knowledge from having taught the film classes. But I think that aesthetic in The Magnificent Seven really was a nod to The Seven Samurai.
Oh, yeah.
That it was kind of pulling from that Japanese, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it comes from that approach to storytelling, which definitely has a significant difference to, oddly enough, Westerns, and kind of the way Westerns were approached earlier than the 1960s, more like in the 50s. You know, by 1960, then, you know, different kind of movie making was happening than the original Westerns, but.
This numbers can't be right. The box office budget for the film was $2 million. The gross of the film in the United States was just under $270,000.
Seems different now, huh?
Very. And it's considered an essential film. I mean,
mm-hmm. That's what I was kind of leading into, was the significance of it in terms of Western filmmaking, mm-hmm. breaking out of the standard approaches, the John, what's his name? Who's the famous cowboy actor?
John Wayne.
The John Wayne approach to Westerns. It really did kind of break out of that cookie cutter into making Western something different.
Yeah. And it also was, directed by Akira Kurosawa. So,
right. Yeah.
I mean, he's just... Yep. Phenomenal. And I didn't get a chance to watch Seven Samurai. I wanted to do that, but it's 200 minutes long.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to sit down and enjoy it. So,
Yeah. You have to carve out a time for that.
And I've got to cleanse my palate from Huntsman. It may take 3.5 hours to do that.
Well, my almost suggestion for Netflix was... The Princess Bride.
Yes, it's out there on Netflix. Yeah. People watch it.
Yes. That was the first one I saw. I'm like, oh, I've recommended that movie far too many times. I need to
Have you
to
met people out. Who haven't seen it?
I don't think I have, actually.
We've met a couple of people at work who have not seen it, and we're like, okay, you know, go see it, and then we'll be friends. But
oh, yeah. I have a wonderful story or wonderful memories of going to the only movie rental place in town that had Betamax movies for rent. Betamax.
Yes, I was going to let that sit out there. My iPod thing.
You had the iPod, I bring up the Betamax.
You win.
Yeah, exactly. With my mom, and you know, they had a very limited selection because even by that time Betamax were on their way out, and finding The Princess Bride and just absolutely falling in love with it from that moment forward. So if you haven't seen it, you really should.
Yeah.
So, Netflix.
The backup.
Yep.
Well,
yep.
Thanks for joining us. We're having a really good time getting back to the podcasting. And, of course, we both love movies. And we really like revisiting some of these suggestions that we can give to you on streaming. Our series does continue through August. It'll be monthly.
It's going to be really hard to pick a film for next month. May starts out the summer blockbusters, really. This was kind of what's a precursor to a blockbuster? Like, what's one step down from a blockbuster? Just a buster?
That's The Huntsman.
Yeah, that was The Huntsman. The buster. So we have coming up Captain America Civil War, the Angry Birds movie, and X-Men Apocalypse. So there's some good stuff coming out, and so we're thinking about what we're going to watch for May. If you have a recommendation for our summer movie series or a comment about The Huntsman Winter's War, let us know on our website, thegeekembassy.com.
We are The Geek Embassy. I'm Rhonda Oglesby, the Wild Card Ambassador, telling you to fire up that console, put on some stretchy pants, and pop the popcorn. I'll be right over.
And I'm Regina McMenemy, Lead Ambassador for the Geek Embassy. You can find our podcast episodes and hangouts on iTunes, Stitcher, and our podcast host Podbean, all under the Geek Embassy. You can find all the links for these on the geekembassy.com. And make sure to check out the new and exciting content we're creating on the site. Huge, many, many huge thanks for our fantastic editor, Ryan Broom at Desert Tree Media, and our faithful listeners and community. Thanks for listening, and until next time, get your geek on!